Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why so many Gen Z voters say they plan to vote this fall, even though the two major parties aren't addressing their concerns, and tracking a desert songbird whose habitat is being threatened here. But first, when the Arizona Coyotes were sold and moved to Salt Lake City earlier this year, the NHL said there was a chance the team would be able to come back. That was contingent on owner Alex Morello winning an auction for state trust land in North Phoenix and building an arena there. But last month, the state land department canceled that auction, and then Morello reportedly told Coyote staff that he was no longer pursuing land on which to build an arena. So what does all of that mean for the future of pro hockey in the Valley? With me to talk about that is Brandon Brown, senior reporter at the Phoenix Business Journal. Brandon, good morning. Brandon, are you with us? We're going to try to reconnect with Brandon. We're sure he's around somewhere. We'll just try to get him on the line and come back to that conversation in just a moment. Meanwhile, races at the top of November's ballot are generating a lot of attention, but Governor Katie Hobbs says she's focusing much of her energy a little farther down on races for the state legislature. She's made no secret of the fact that she'd like to flip one or both of the chambers. Republicans currently have one-seat majorities in both the state House and Senate. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services has spoken to Governor Hobbs about this and joins me to talk more about it. And Howie, how bullish is the governor on that prospect right now?
Well, what it comes down to is dollars and cents, and she's got them. And that's the point. Look, I don't doubt that prior Democratic governors, whether Bruce Babbitt or Janet Napolitano, wanted to flip the legislature blue. What this governor has is a little bit of a war chest. Even though she's not up for re-election until 2026, her financial people tell me she's already got over $1 million collected in her 2026 campaign account. Now, you may also remember that there was a whole kerfuffle over money collected for an inaugural that only cost less than $300,000, and they collected over $1.5 million. That's also been set aside. You can buy a lot of TV and radio time and newspaper ads with that. And so what she's looking at doing is using some of that money to help out some Democratic candidates, particularly in these marginal districts where it could go either way, you know, where there are a sufficient number of Republicans and Democrats that the registration is close enough that perhaps with a little bit of cash, she can get out the vote, get people to go to the polls, vote against certain Republicans, and make a difference. Like I say, money really talks.
Yeah. Well, has she said how much she is looking to or maybe willing to spend in this endeavor?
Not really. I think that's still being worked out. I think a lot of it's going to depend on what shows up, for example, next week and how much she actually has put aside. That's when the first set of campaign finance reports are due. I think it's going to come down to wanting to use the money wisely. Look, it makes no sense, for example, to put a lot of money into a legislative district out in Sun City, say, because there's a Democrat out there and say, oh, well, we're going to flip the district. You know, why do that? But then we see the same thing on the presidential level. We know that both candidates have decided they're going to spend their money on certain states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, where they might have a reasonable chance. The other piece of it is going to be how much can you buy and how much ad space is out there? All you need to do is turn on your television now and see that we haven't even reached the primary and the ad airwaves are saturated with political commercials. Now, there's just so much space to go around. You know, unlike a newspaper, you can add 6 or 7 pages. I haven't figured out, unless you can bend the laws of time and space, to add another 2 hours to a 24-hour day to put in new political ads.
Right. Well, so has she targeted specific districts? I mean, there's a handful that are considered competitive swing districts. Has she decided which one she is looking to potentially get involved in?
Again, I think she's keeping it close to her vest, but she's mentioned, you know, some of the districts, for example, you have some districts in Mesa that have elected at least one Democrat and one Republican in the House. Well, why not two Democrats? You have some Central Phoenix districts, you know, people like Judy Schwiebert, who got elected in what might be considered a moderately Republican district, where maybe they could elect a second Democrat, depending on what they want to do. Of course, a lot of what they're looking to do is what they call single shotting. In other words, if you have a House vote, you say, vote for two people. Well, if there's two Republicans and one Democrat on the dish on the ballot, you may say, well, I'll give one and one. And that helps. And that's a little separate from the money issue, but it comes down to strategizing of how to do this. Now, remember, it isn't going to take much to change the legislature. There are 31 Republicans and 29 Democrats in the House, and 16 Republicans and 14 Democrats in the Senate. You add one Democrat to either one, and you've got split government, something we haven't had since the 1990s in the Senate, have never had in the House since, you know, 64, which is the last time the Democrats were in control there. Mm-hmm. If you add two, now you're really talking, because you can actually make a big difference. Not only do you have a Democrat House, maybe a Democrat Senate, but a Democrat governor who can go ahead and say, sure, I'll sign these things, and I won't do another 143 vetoes like I did my first year in office, because I don't need to,
right. Because
you won't be sending me that sort of stuff.
So, Howie, let's talk about something else going on related to the election. That is the border security measure that legislative Republicans referred to the ballot. There was a hearing on Monday over a challenge to that based on the state's single subject rule. How did that go? What were some of the arguments?
What this comes down to is the concept of log rolling. In other words, what the Supreme Court has said, generally speaking, you shouldn't have to accept something you don't want to get something you do want that's unrelated. The argument by the challengers is, look, perhaps you'd like something to tighten up the laws on the sale of fentanyl that causes a death. Should that be related to securing the border? Should that be related to public benefits? And the argument is that they're unrelated, and therefore you can't have them on a single ballot. Obviously, the Corey Langhofer, who represents the Republican legislative leader, said, well, it's all related to the issue of an insecure border, and that we know a lot of the fentanyl comes across the border, and so we can make an assumption that it is related, even though the people could be arrested for fentanyl sales who are actually U.S. citizens, which would have nothing to do with border crossers. I think the judge is a little concerned, particularly about the fentanyl part, and in fact, at one point questioned one of the attorneys saying, so if the fentanyl part wasn't in here, would you be okay with the measure? And Andrew Gaona, who represents Podere and a few immigrant groups, said, sure. Now, here's the tricky part. The law does not allow the judge to simply excise the offending material.
Right.
It's an all or nothing proposal. So if the judge decides one or more of these proposals violates a single subject rule, he has to bounce the whole thing from the ballot. Now, of course, remembering whoever loses is going to go ahead and eventually take this to the state Supreme Court. And they really need an answer from the Supreme Court by mid-August, because now you're starting to print up general election ballots, and they need to know what will be on the ballot.
So has this judge said when they plan to issue a ruling?
I think Judge Minter would like to issue a ruling by the end of the week, again, giving the Court of Appeals and the state Supreme Court sufficient time to say, okay, am I right or am I wrong? But he wants to also make sure that his wording is justified. It's not just, I think this way, but how he got to the ruling. And then the appellate courts can decide, you know, does that logic make sense? Hard to know what the Supreme Court will do. You know, there were a lot of people who thought that the abortion measure that the Supreme Court upheld, the 1864 law, would never have happened. Mm-hmm. And court that's become, like the U.S. Supreme Court, more conservative, this having to do with Doug Ducey appointments. What would they do with it? Hard to say.
Well, it seems like at some point we're going to find out. So that is
always.
All right. That is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always. I appreciate it.
Have a great day.
And now let's go back to Brandon Brown, senior reporter at the Phoenix Business Journal, to talk about the future of pro hockey in the Valley after the Arizona Coyotes' departure earlier this year. Brandon, can you hear me?
I can't hear you.
All right.
I wanted to hear Howie first.
So many of us do. So let's start with this land auction that was canceled seemingly at the last minute by the land department. What rationale did the agency give for taking that step?
The state land department said that the way the land was zoned currently was not wouldn't wouldn't support an NHL arena, pro hockey arena. And I guess the city of Phoenix's zoning department was telling the land department that, as well as telling the Coyotes ownership the same thing. The Coyotes ownership, I guess, disagreed with that, but the city and the state were like, no, you got to get the zoning taken care of first before the land auction happens.
Well, so, I mean, you mentioned that the Coyotes seemingly disagreed with that, but like, was there any sense that they knew about it and maybe had a zoning attorney or a land use attorney working with them that told them, no, you guys are on solid legal ground here?
The city of Phoenix says they've made it clear to the Coyotes for a number of months that was the case. But it has become clear in the past couple of weeks that the Coyotes did not have their land attorney, their real estate attorney working on the case for them. They had an attorney working with them up through the getting the auction set, and then they didn't have their usual land attorney, their Arizona-based land attorney working on it, the case with them. So they maybe weren't getting all the information, or it's not clear exactly what the Coyotes were thinking at that point, but they did not have their zoning real estate attorney working on this deal with them.
Yeah. So after that happened, after the auction was canceled, the now former owner, Alex Morello, basically said, look, I'm out. I'm done. It's over for now. And then we heard from the NHL commissioner, Gary Bettman, at the NHL All-Star Game just a short while back that basically they're not looking at Phoenix as an expansion team right now. What specifically did Bettman say, and what kind of response did that generate?
So Gary Bettman has mostly been saying for a long time when it comes to expansion, not just including Phoenix, that he wants someone who there's an owner that has money and willing to spend it, that there's a good arena there, and that there's a market that he says would strengthen the league as a whole. When it comes to the Phoenix, he said that they don't have that Phoenix probably has fans here. He says it's a good market for the NHL. He goes, but they need to have someone who can come in and figure out an arena situation. For almost a decade, the Coyotes were fighting with Glendale about the arena, and the lease was all screwed up over there. And then they, you know, eventually got kicked out of that arena and couldn't find a solution that was a permanent arena solution. So Bettman's pretty much said, until there's a solution for the Coyotes for an arena and an owner who's willing to kind of do the hard work to get that done and can figure out how to make it work here in the Valley, it's not going to happen.
Well, so this seems like at least somewhat of a turnaround for Bettman, who for years, during all of the fighting, as you referenced, you know, sort of the bad feelings and the struggle to get a permanent arena between the Coyotes and Glendale and then Tempe, Bettman was very bullish on this market, on Phoenix as a hockey market. And now he's kind of saying, maybe not. Like, is that the right way to read it? Is this, in fact, a change of heart for Bettman?
It's a little bit of a change of heart, but probably more of a realization that he came into reality that Phoenix has, if hockey in Phoenix has struggled, professional hockey has struggled here in Phoenix. It never has taken off like I think Bettman wanted it to when he first helped move the Coyotes here from Winnipeg in the late 90s. He's always been a champion for this. I think probably deep down in his heart, I've talked to him a couple of times. I think he really thinks that Phoenix should be a great hockey town, and he doesn't maybe understand 100% why. It hasn't had the fan support. It hasn't been able to get the ownership and the political backing that he thinks that it should have. But at the same time, I think that he saw the writing on the wall that it wasn't happening here in Phoenix, and that Salt Lake City, where the team eventually was moved to, had a lot of support there. They had an owner with deep pockets who was willing to spend money. And the fan reaction in Salt Lake has been very high, more than it's ever was in Phoenix when it was here. So before the games have even started, over 30,000 people have put down deposits for season tickets, which is way more than the season tickets they have in Salt Lake. So I think he's seeing maybe there's greener pastures.
All right, Brandon, before we let you go, do you get the sense? I mean, have you heard from folks that there is some kind of effort afoot to find an owner or ownership group that can put up the money and figure out an arena situation and try to bring a pro hockey team back to the Valley?
Yeah, one hockey fans, because there are some hockey fans here and they are really dedicated and really passionate and really want to have hockey here. They're calling for it. And there are some groups, a couple of, it's in really early stages of it, but I've heard that there are some groups that want to put down some money who'd be interested in it, but it's still kind of early to say whether it's actually going to happen or not.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Brandon Brown, senior reporter at the Phoenix Business Journal. Brandon, thanks for your time. Thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, using tiny backpacks, a team of scientists tracks the migration of a desert songbird for the first time ever.
So we put on these little backpacks, send them on their way, and we wait a year. And then we return the next year to the same saguaro and hope that the bird is there.
The effort to save desert purple martins. But first, a majority of Gen Z voters say neither of the two major political parties represent them. But at the same time, two-thirds of them say they still plan to vote in November's election. Those are among the findings of a new report from ASU's Center for an Independent and Sustainable Democracy called Frustrated but Engaged. The data also show that nearly half of these voters under the age of 30 are not registered with a political party. Tom Riley is co-director of the center, and he joins me to talk about what the report means. And Tom, let's start with this dichotomy in which Gen Z voters say the two major political parties basically don't care all that much about them, but those voters still plan to cast ballots in November.
Right. You know, I think a lot of the national polling is suggesting after record-breaking participation of young people in 2020 and 2022 that there's perhaps going to be a fall off in 24. So we were really interested in looking at those that were registered in Arizona to see whether they're going to show up at the polls. You know, it was interesting in 2022, two-thirds of them that were registered didn't vote. Right? So we were kind of interested to see, you know, if you are going to vote, you know, what would drive you to the polls and what is your participation? And as you said, young people are frustrated with the system, right? But they're still engaged and they still are indicating that, you know, they're going to exercise their right to vote, which I thought was very encouraging. You know, two-thirds of these young people said they're very likely or likely to show up in November.
Well, so what do they plan on doing? Like, who are they planning on voting for if they're not really thrilled with either of the two major parties?
Yeah, so if we looked at those that were registered, I mean, this group of Gen Z voters in Arizona are distinctly independent. Mm-hmm. About 50% of them are independent, more than the two parties combined. About a third are Latino. So what we did was we asked them specifically what are some of their top issues. And like the general population, most of the drivers are economic. Their cost of living, housing affordability, health care and jobs. We also saw that reproductive rights and fair and secure election were top issues for them. And singling a regional issue, water was top of mind. Which I think also underscores that this group of voters, despite concerns that they're disengaged, are engaged on the issues. They, as I said, are frustrated. They feel like most politicians are corrupt. Four or five of them feel that the two major parties don't represent their interest or the interest of the country, which we found was very startling, that number. And I can tell you that when I was doing the focus groups, putting the survey together, this was a significant thematic issue of the young people and voicing their I characterize it as anger. I mean, they're saying that the parties are not helpful in giving them information to make informed decisions. Everything is so polarized. We have these complex issues that we're trying to understand, and the parties have these two, you know, diametrically opposed positions. So they're not using the parties for their information. But they seem still engaged in the major issues of the day.
Does it seem as though they feel about the parties mostly at the top of the ticket? Like, do they make a distinction between how maybe the presidential candidates in the Democratic and Republican parties talk or the Senate candidates versus, let's say, a state legislative candidate or other sort of down ballot races? Or is it all kind of the same to them?
Well, we did ask the fall off from, you know, are you going to participate in at the presidential level, then for Congress and Senate, state races, ballot issues, and then judicial races. And we did see some falling off, particularly around the issue of nonpartisan judicial races. Mm-hmm. But surprisingly, we saw a good deal of engagement, or at least they're saying they're going to be committed to looking at those issues, particularly some of the ballot issues. Now, the ballot issues were very interesting because of those individuals that did not vote in 2022, which is about two-thirds of those that are registered.
Yeah.
The drivers for many of those, particularly the independents, were the ballot issues, were the open and fair elections with reproductive rights and minimum wage.
Hmm.
They indicated that those issues in particular would drive them to the polls.
Did they suggest that they would maybe vote for other candidates as well, or are they mostly motivated by those issues, maybe vote for those and pick and choose a couple others but maybe not fill out the whole ballot?
Yeah. Well, a lot of them felt that the two major candidates weren't representative. They wanted more choices.
For president, open, you mean?
Right, for president. They're open to a third-party candidate. We specifically didn't ask them, are you going to vote for the former President Trump or Biden? And we were more interested in specific issues and whether they're going to show up to vote in 24.
So does this tell you then, or at least suggest that the major parties should be trying to talk more about these issues? Does it seem like maybe the ship has sailed on the two major parties really being able to reach this demographic of voters?
Well, if I was part of one of those campaigns, a Republican or Democrat, I would be very alarmed that, you know, we have such a large percent. I mean, first of all, half of them aren't even registered with the parties. They're not even engaged with them. But that 80% felt that the parties were not meeting their interest as young people or the best interest of the country. So, you know, it should be a red flag to the parties that they need to engage with these young people, and they need to engage at the media sources that they're going to be responsive to. And, you know, one of the questions we did ask is, where do you get your media sources and your information? Now, again, going back to this focus groups, I pushed a lot of the young people on this too, that the reality is that most of them get it from social media. Mm-hmm. TikTok in particular is where they're getting their information. But I was very interested in how do they fact check? Do they just accept this information at face value?
Yeah.
And I was real surprised of the pushback I got. And they're saying, you know, we're introduced to these issues on these platforms, but it doesn't mean we don't Google them, right, to fact check. So we're not just taking everything at face value.
So given that you're looking at specifically Gen Z voters, the youngest voters who are able to be registered, what does what you found maybe suggest about what the future of politics in Arizona might be like? I mean, we've seen, for example, independents are usually the second most popular group behind Republicans. Does this in any way signal some kind of shift going forward as these voters grow up and maybe some of the older voters stop voting?
I do. I think it's going to be very interesting to track Gen Z voters to see if these numbers stick on those that are registered, not just say they're independent, but actually registered independent.
Yeah.
And it could be somewhat of a bellwether, right, that as our politics become more polarized and people are leaving parties, this may be where many other states are going. It's interesting. Last week, Gallup came out with their monthly statistics about political affiliation. And historically, now 51% of those in the U.S. identify as independents.
Hmm.
So this group will be really interesting to see if these numbers hold. And I think that has pretty dramatic implications for how our partisan system works, right? And particularly, you know, when there's issues out there, there's candidates or there's or ballots that people don't understand, they tend to go to their political playbooks, right, the Republicans and Democrats. Now we have a whole generation of young people that have never used those playbooks. So these platforms where they're getting their information are more important. And equipping young people with the tools to fact check and make informed decisions are really important. And if the parties would offer that instead of this polarized rhetoric that is clearly turning off this generation of voters, I think they can make great strides with this population.
All right. Well, Tom, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Tom Riley is the co-director of the Center for an Independent and Sustainable Democracy at ASU. Arizona is, of course, familiar with extreme heat, but there are parts of the country that have been experiencing it in recent years that have not previously. And in many cases, low-income communities are dealing with disproportionate impacts of that extreme heat, both here in Arizona and elsewhere. With me to talk about this is Dr. Alonzo Plow, Chief Science Officer and Vice President for Research, Evaluation, and Learning at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And Dr. Plow, when we're talking about the impacts of extreme heat, especially on low-income communities, how much worse is it for residents in lower-income neighborhoods and others in other socioeconomic strata?
Well, it's much worse, and I think it's really around what heat does. I mean, heat is itself a stressor on health. I mean, heat can kill. Heat can cause stroke, but it also exacerbates underlying conditions. So in a low-income neighborhood or a communities of color who have been in neighborhoods that don't have amenities like good open access to parks and tree cover, those neighborhoods, just because of their physical environments, pavement instead of green space, could be 20 degrees higher than a neighborhood that has those kind of amenities. And so they're going to be hotter. But if you also look at what other health inequalities are in that neighborhood, in those communities, excess rates of asthma and older vulnerable elders with multiple chronic illnesses, heat exacerbates that underlying health inequity. So those are some of the factors that compound the risk in those communities of climate change and extreme weather.
Does heat cause those impacts more than other sort of environmental factors in terms of extreme cold or like really bad air quality, things like that?
Well, it multiplies and exacerbates things, particularly like bad air quality. It makes that worse. That's why it makes asthma worse. It makes the effect of those particulates and the asthma triggers more severe. But I think that in terms of the impact of extreme weather on health, heat kills more people every year than every other heat-related or climate change-related factor combined. So heat kills more people than hurricanes, floods, tornadoes combined. So when you're talking about the effect of extreme weather on health, which is really the human face of climate change, heat is the number one problem.
So what then can and should cities and towns be doing about this, especially maybe in these low-income communities where people, as you say, are more directly and disproportionately impacted?
Well, you're in a state that is, you know, part probably one of the central places where heat is just a problem for everybody.
Yeah.
And your heat-related deaths, you know, across the state and Maricopa County have just been like 50% higher in the last couple of years than before. So I think in terms of what you do, let's just start local and start. I was a former public health official, emergency responder type. So the first thing you need to do for higher risk communities, low income communities of color, is make sure that at a local level, you're opening cooling centers, you're opening opportunities for people to get out of these really high heat days. In the longer run, I think on a local level, having low income neighborhoods that have more asphalt and concrete than trees and open space, longer term, local responsibilities to create those sort of green space and trees that help to mitigate the impact of heat. Also, I think very quickly, and I think this is certainly the case in Arizona, air conditioning isn't some extra amenity. It has to be available to everybody, low-income folks particularly. And so local approaches for low-income energy assistance for running those air conditioners are become very, very important. But I think at the national level, heat is one of the major causes of worker death. So I think at a national level, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration and also state officials need to provide stronger regulations to protect workers who work outside or in factory and production situations where the ventilation and the temperatures rise dramatically in the summer.
When you look at how states and cities and communities in those states are doing on some of these things, you mentioned Arizona, you know, has a lot of experience in this area. How are we doing? How is the state doing and how are its cities doing in trying to mitigate the impacts of extreme heat, especially on low-income communities relative to states and communities elsewhere around the country?
Well, you have one of the highest, as you know quite well, Arizona has some of the highest heat in the country, on a you know, even 20 years ago. So your state has an increasing number of heat caused deaths over the last couple of years and emergency room visits. And, you know, I've known your state and local Maricopa County health officials over many years. So I know there's a recognition of this, and I know that some of the things that I've talked about, the cooling centers, particular attention to communities of color, low-income areas, nursing homes, vulnerable elders, your public health officials have been aware and have developed programs for many years. But again, the heat is getting worse, and you don't want to pick it up in emergency room visits for heat-related illness. The real importance is in a more prevention approach. And I know in many communities in Arizona, there have been efforts to create more heat-resistant environments. Putting white paint and white structures on rooftops can help to mitigate that. There are a number of urban design and community design issues that can help to provide more cooling in those neighborhoods. So I know cities in Arizona have been implementing those things, but it's a serious public health problem that's just been getting worse with the impact of climate change and particularly health.
Sure. All right. We're going to have to leave it there. That is Dr. Alonzo Plow, Chief Science Officer and Vice President for Research, Evaluation, and Learning at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Thank you so much for your time. Thanks for your insights. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. And now let's talk about birds. One specific species of birds, in fact, desert purple martins. They nest in saguaros, and as climate change threatens the health of these behemoths of the Sonoran Desert, one researcher is working to make sure these little birds survive. Victoria Wiley is a PhD student at Northern Arizona University, and she spent the last several years putting tiny backpacks on desert purple martins and tracking them on their yearly migration. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with her more about it.
So I actually grew up in the Sonoran Desert, kind of near Phoenix, and I had never noticed a purple martin once until I started studying them. But once you kind of recognize them and notice them, you see them everywhere. Hmm. So these birds are, they like to perch on saguaros, and they are all, the males are all dark. So if you see them from far away, they look like kind of, you know, smaller black birds. But when you see them in the sunlight, they are iridescent blue, absolutely beautiful.
Wow.
They like to be in flight. They eat insects only. So you'll see them flying a lot, and then they'll land and perch on a saguaro for a little while and then take off in flight again.
Okay. So the saguaro is their nesting place, essentially, right? What got you interested in studying them?
I have always been really, really fascinated by migration. And just the thought of animals being able to migrate thousands of miles, whether it's sea animals, birds, insects, it's just fascinating. And so when I started at NAU, I had this project in mind where these purple martins are migratory birds that migrate from all over North America. In our case, the desert purple martins, they are exclusively in the Sonoran Desert, and they fly thousands of miles to Brazil every year to spend the winter. And then they fly all the way back to the desert and breed in the saguaros.
Interesting. Okay. And they're threatened because of this, right? Because of that saguaro kind of landing spot for them, right?
Yeah. And so the desert purple martins are really unique because they use that saguaro to build their nest. So those are subjected to wildfires in the Sonoran Desert with climate change and habitat destruction. And then on their wintering grounds, they also have threats, unfortunately. So in Brazil, it's a hotspot for mercury contamination due to illegal gold mining, hydroelectric dams, all of these different reasons. And so the desert purple martins are especially threatened and are in a unique position because they have threats both on their breeding and wintering grounds.
Oh, wow. Okay. So your work is focused on figuring out their migration patterns, right? And is the goal to help them in this process, to help them survive going forward?
Yeah, definitely. So with migratory animals, any species, you can't just protect their breeding grounds or their wintering grounds. It really has to be both. And that's what's so special about working in this field and conservation is that you have the opportunity to have international collaborations. It takes trans-hemispheric, transcontinental efforts to conserve animals like this. So migratory species are kind of complicated to conserve, but also really rewarding.
So let's talk about how you do this work, because it's really, really interesting and kind of cute, too, right? Like what you're putting on in order to study the migration patterns of these birds, you actually put trackers on them that look like kind of like tiny little backpacks, right?
Yep.
Tell us about those. How do they work?
So the backpacks that we've used in the past, there's a few different kinds, but the kinds that we've used for purple martins are, one is called a geolocator. So those are kind of more primitive technology. It uses, well, primitive now. I mean, mm-hmm. they've only been around for about 15 years, but they basically track when the sun is rising and when the sun is setting. And based off of those data, you can tell where the animal is on the globe, basically. So we've used geolocators. They're a little bit less expensive than the other type we've used, which are GPS trackers. And so GPS, it kind of works like how you would pull up GPS on your phone. You can sure. tell the exact tree that bird wow. is in with GPS trackers. They're more expensive, but when we found out that we were successful with geolocators, we thought, let's spend the extra money and let's get a really precise reading so we can protect this wintering grounds and find out where they're going and try to move conservation forward in that way.
Okay, so how do you do this? Like, how do you get these trackers or tiny backpacks on the birds themselves? And you have to get them back at the end, right?
Yes, yeah. So the desert purple martins, like I said, they're really unique. Purple martins are pretty much all throughout the East Coast. There's a population in California, but these desert birds that we have in Arizona are really, really unique because they nest in the saguaros. Other parts of the country, purple martins nest in nest boxes. So it's a lot easier to take the nest box down and do what you need to with the bird. These birds are wild. So they do not take to nest boxes. They are nesting in, you know, you've seen saguaros. They are 40 feet up in the air sometimes,
yes.
the cavities. And so we use what are called mist nets. It's kind of like a volleyball net.
Okay.
And we're out there sometimes for hours and hours and hours, and we do not catch any birds. And then the next day we'll be out there for hours and hours and hours, and we'll catch two birds.
Okay.
And so we'll do this for weeks on end to try to get as many as we can, because like you mentioned, you have to get the bird back. So we put on these little backpacks, send them on their way, and we wait a year. And then we return the next year to the same saguaro. And hope that the bird is there. And so last year we were so excited to get basically the very first record of the desert purple martin migration path. We deployed 8 geolocators and we had a male that came back to the same saguaro. We recaptured him, got his little tag off. He was probably happy to have the backpack off. He felt light as a feather. And it was really exciting.
So what did you find?
We found that the desert purple martins actually winter in a separate location of Brazil. So not only do they breed in a unique location, the Sonoran Desert, they're isolated in their breeding grounds. They're also isolated on their wintering grounds. And what this could mean is when species or subspecies are isolated for thousands and thousands of years, they can eventually evolve into their own species. And so that's a new part of this project that we're looking into, is their genetics, to see whether or not the desert purple martin could in fact become their own species.
Okay, so you're continuing this work, right? Like this summer, you're going to be collecting tracker tags from another round of desert purple martins. Are you hoping you'll get more than one this time?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, so we'll be out there again this summer collecting the ones from last year. And what's very exciting about this year is we've upgraded yet again to a different type of tracker. These ones are called satellite trackers. And this is basically, it's the best of the best right now. With the satellite tags, we do not have to retrieve the bird again. So we'll send out, we got about 8 of those. And so we'll deploy those this summer and we will not have to recollect that tag in hopes of having way more data. So right now we have data for one individual. We will, after this summer, hopefully have data for several. And it's just a lot more informative when you have more data points.
Yeah, makes sense. Okay, so what is your goal here? Like, what do you hope this data leads you to in terms of helping to, as you said, sort of preserve this species in a climate change era?
Our main goal here is figuring out where these birds spend the winter so that we can actually go to that area, speak with the community, ask about, you know, what problems they're facing and figure out what's going on with these birds, because it really goes beyond the birds in a sense. You know, the issues that the birds are facing can affect tons of other animals. It can affect humans. For example, the mercury exposure, it goes beyond the birds. So if we could figure out where they're migrating to and quantify the mercury in their feathers, figure out maybe what they're exposed to, we can help a larger audience, basically, of animals as well as people.
Yeah. All right. That is Victoria Wiley, PhD student at NAU, joining us to talk more about her research into desert purple martins. Victoria, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Psychedelics have officially gone mainstream, but as our Instagram feeds fill up with ads for mail-order ketamine and public officials endorse the potential for magic mushrooms to help treat PTSD symptoms, there's one substance we don't hear all that much about, LSD. The molecule that came to symbolize late 60s counterculture has largely faded from public favor. In his new book, Blotter, The Untold Story of an Acid Medium, writer Eric Davis considers the curious rise and fall of LSD and the equally curious artistic tradition that's developed as the drug's popularity fades. Davis recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about blotter art and the way that tiny images can help tell a much bigger story.
LSD blotter is paper that holds the acid because LSD is so tiny and so powerful that you can't take it straight. It needs what the the feds call a carrier medium. So you can put it in capsules, you can put it on sugar cubes, or you can put it on paper. And blotter paper usually comes in a square or rectangular piece of sort of light cardstock, a little lighter than a business card, but not a loose piece of paper. And those pieces of paper are often covered with art, abstract patterns and cartoons and animal illustrations, UFOs, gods and goddesses, pretty much everything you can imagine.
One of the ones you talk about that's particularly famous in the book is a kind of adaptation of Mickey Mouse from Fantasia, right?
Yeah. In the case of the Mickey, which really was quite celebrated in the late 70s when it first appeared, the artist drew a unique image of Mickey sort of playing with these magical dots and sort of suggests some of the Faustian dimension of the acid manufacture itself. And of course, didn't make Disney very happy.
Yeah, I can imagine. This to me is where the book gets really, really interesting because, as you write, the goal in using those markers like, Mickey Mouse or something seems to be, if I'm not mistaken, sending a sort of winking message to the person who's going to ingest the acid that, like, this may remind you of the straight world, but this substance is going to give you a peek behind the veil and show you what's really going on, so to speak.
Exactly. And that wink is really important. I mean, one of the characteristics of acid culture is that it's funny. You know, the consumer world of icons and sort of brands, takes on a life of its own.
Which I think is particularly interesting in light of another section that I found fascinating, where you talk about the fact that unlike other psychedelics, LSD has this kind of industrialist origin story.
Yeah, that's a really important part of this. You know, one of the features of the psychedelic renaissance today is that many people are very interested in natural psychedelics. Ayahuasca, which is a jungle brew, psychedelic mushrooms, which have a history of indigenous use. But LSD, the history of LSD, it emerges just at the very heart of modernity, you know, right there smack dab in the middle of World War II in the strange neutral country of Switzerland in an industrial lab from a corporation that was founded on the transformation of coal tar into dyes. So it's like absolutely woven into modernity, and it's sold to psychiatrists, and then it gets picked up by the CIA, and they try to do something with it. And in a way, one of the reasons that I like LSD history is that for those of us who are not indigenous, they're kind of our ancestors.
Yeah.
It's like our wisdom legacy.
I want to quote a section from the book that I think speaks to that, where you put it so eloquently. You say, "Whatever its alchemical resonance, LSD sprouts from the brow of industrial chemistry, an industry founded on artificial dyes and petroleum products, and it enlists shrinks and spies as some of its earliest shamans." That makes me think of the element of the book where you talk about the debate about whether blotter art can be considered folk art or outsider art.
Yeah, I mean, the first person who talked about that was Carla McCormick. And he was and is a New York City art critic, and he talks about them as a folk art, and I think in some ways it's an appropriate way of thinking about it. These are marginal products. Again, they're largely anonymous. They're done for very pragmatic purposes. They're considered, you know, they're not even considered illustration, let alone art, by most people. But in other ways, when we talk about folk art and when we talk about outsider art, we are usually also talking about where the art is being produced vis-a-vis the various layers of society. So usually outsider artists are, you know, people who are at the margins of society. And that's not really the case with a lot of the blotter artists, at least initially. They're marginal because they choose to live in a kind of freak criminal underground. But a lot of them were very well educated. They knew their art history. They had learned how to do these things sometimes through college and university, you know, like the hippies in general. They're upper middle class, generally white. And that gives it a kind of different twist that I think in a way doesn't quite folk art and outsider art don't quite work.
But some of that also, it seems, has to do with the fact that LSD has undergone this transition from this drug that had an aura of sacredness and kind of being the savior of culture to something weirder and more underground, and that transition kind of coincides with the rise of blotter art. So how did that happen?
I think it is partly just a coincidence. People started to print blotter in the early 70s, but it was kind of a niche thing. And then for a variety of reasons, it takes off in the late 1970s and really hits its stride in the 1980s and 90s when the really colorful, funny, charming, sometimes quite magical pieces come out. And that coincides with the sort of decline of visible utopian LSD culture.
Yeah, well, I guess it also strikes me that a lot of the things that the 60s generation was worried about have come to pass, right? All the idealism that those earlier folks seemed to hope LSD would bring about didn't happen.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, there's definitely, you know, it's a very different world. But in a way, that asks an even subtler question, which is, do they make a difference? Part of what the psychedelic renaissance is about kind of reframing and modernizing that idealism to a more manageable scale, in the sense of, like, we may not be able to change the world, but let's see if we can just change individuals or perhaps communities, at least in their ability to, you know, show up to life with more energy, more humor, more ability to respond from the heart, less trauma, less neurosis. And one of the core truths about psychedelics is the law of set and setting, that the experience you have will be partly dependent on your mindset and the setting, the environment. But that environment, that situation, includes the shape and the look of the material and how you're taking it. Maybe it does make a difference if you eat a flying saucer or Bart Simpson's slingshot. But, you know, it's ultimately a mystery.
Eric Davis, author of Blotter, The Untold Story of an Acid Medium. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, it's been great talking. Thank you so much, too.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. Don't forget, you can follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ, the show. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow.